Haitian TPS has ended. What happens next? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Temporary protected status for roughly 60,000 Haitians living in the U.S. is going to end by summer of 2019. Many live here in South Florida. So what happens next? The Houston Astros are the world champions, but not everyone in Palm Beach County, where the team holds its spring training, is happy. There are business owners that are angry they have yet to be paid for the work done on the team's brand new baseball facility in South Florida. Also, we'll meet the award-winning owner of a local restaurant featuring Persian, French, and American comfort food. And how much do you know about Miami's underground music scene? Lauren Reskin of Sweat Records will give us the primer on who's up and coming. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, we found out today that the temporary protected status for tens of thousands of Haitians in the U.S. is going to come to an end in 2019. So what's going to happen to them? What happens next? And, well, what are their options for all of those Haitians who have been living in the U.S. for so many years? Perhaps going back to Haiti isn't the best idea for them. Well, I spoke with Patricia Mazet of the Miami Herald a little earlier today, and she gave us an update. Patty, can you explain what the new DHS ruling ending temporary protected status for Haitians is going to mean? When does it end?
It's going to mean that Haitians in the U.S. who are under TPS protection will no longer have it as of July 22nd, 2019. So it was set to expire in January 22nd, 2018, and the Department of Homeland Security essentially gave an 18-month reprieve before the program will be terminated. So there will be no more extensions after that, according to the administration.
So people who are here under the TPS, what do they do now if they want to stay?
So as of July 22nd, 2019, they would go back to whatever their immigration status in the U.S. was before they were covered by TPS, which means if they were in the country illegally, they will be subject to deportation.
Are there people who've come since TPS was granted after the earthquake in 2010, or have some folks been here even longer?
Well, there are some folks who have been here longer. I think some have been here, 13 years. Maybe they were covered under a previous immigration status, and then they fell under TPS. But the 59,000 or so Haitians who are in the U.S., most of them in South Florida, are largely people who came after the earthquake, the 7.0 magnitude quake in 2010.
Do you have any idea how many of these affected Haitians here in South Florida have children who were born in the U.S.? Do we know?
It is a pretty large number. I think it's about 27,000 U.S.-born children in that among that population of people who are protected by TPS.
So what happens to those families?
That is a good question. I mean, what the administration was saying in their announcement was they have a little more than 18 months to kind of make plans to legalize their status in some way, if that's a possibility for them, and if not, to make plans to return to Haiti.
South Florida has one of the largest Haitian communities in the U.S. What is this going to mean for areas like Little Haiti and Delray Beach?
Well, what elected officials from both political parties are saying is that this decision is going to be devastating for those communities because it's going to place new uncertainty on them. And it could decimate some of the community fabric if some relatives have to go back to Haiti and others have to stay here. So we have Republicans and Democrats here in South Florida criticizing it. Senator Bill Nelson called it unconscionable. They had a bipartisan news conference this morning saying that they opposed the decision. And the route that some of them are suggesting is legislation passed by Congress to help legalize the status of some of these folks, like legislation that would have to be passed between now and July of 2019.
And again, that's Patricia Mazet of the Miami Herald. I spoke to her earlier today. Let me correct myself that it was last night when the announcement came down that, again, temporary protected status for tens of thousands of Haitians living in the U.S. is going to come to an end in 2019. Stay tuned throughout the day and throughout the week, and we will keep you informed on that story. Well, the Houston Astros won this year's World Series championship, and that's going to be special for Astros fans here in South Florida. See, the Astros have their spring training in Palm Beach County in a brand spanking new stadium, and that's where the problems abound. The stadium was built very quickly, and there were alleged problems with the construction. Some of the subcontractors in that project say they still haven't been paid. Well, there are lawsuits flying. Other companies are too small to do that, and they're looking for any option to get their money back. What happens now? Well, we're joined by Joe Capozzi of the Palm Beach Post, who's going to give us that update. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's set the scene, though, real quick. There was a rush to build this spring training facility that houses the Houston Astros and the Washington Nationals. Why was there a rush to build this?
Well, the negotiations started almost probably 2 years earlier. The project originally was for the city of Palm Beach Gardens. That got bantered about. The city rejected it. The Astros had to find a new suitor. They found the Nationals. And there were just a lot of moving parts with the additional team and breaking the leases at their old places. And the county tourism folks got on board with it, and they wanted to start marketing it for the 2017 season. And lo and behold, they agreed that the opening would be February of 2017. And, the challenge was that they're reaching these agreements in spring of 2015. They didn't break ground until November of 2015. So that's kind of like a 12 to 15-month window to get the work done.
And barely 15 months. That is very fast for a big facility like this.
Yes, it's extremely fast. It's been done before, but I'm not sure if it's been done before for a two-team facility with two clubhouses, twice the number of practice fields. But the big wrinkle with the project was that they were building it over a former landfill, 160 acres, and the landfill had been abandoned for 20 years. So they weren't sure what was buried under it, how long it would take to get rid of the debris, and that process, the clearing and preparing the land for vertical construction, that took longer than expected. So really, they had like an 8-month window to build the stadium and the clubhouses. And I can remember being there the day the Astros players arrived, and there were players walking through in street clothes for the first time next to welders, and sparks were flying, and they had the masks on, and people were tightening bolts and painting stuff. But the players were told, hey, this isn't going to be quite a finished product, bear with us. And, they didn't complain too much, at least not publicly. And it didn't seem to affect them either. The Astros won the World Series. The Nationals won another division title. But the problem now is that the teams have left. They're going to be coming back in a few months, and the place still isn't finished. There's $12 million in outstanding projects that still need to be done. And the teams in the county are starting to lose patience with the contractor.
And the fact, the fact that it was built on a former landfill, the jokes abound. All right, more than $110 million was secured from from county taxes, tourist taxes, $50 million from the state. The teams are on the hook for a third of the cost, if I'm correct, right?
Correct.
All right. So who's in charge of handling these payments and making sure that the subcontractors, that's where a big problem is here, that the subcontractors are paid?
Well, therein lies the big crux of the problem. It's a complicated process. It involves something called a payment application, and these things can be 100 pages long. And the goal is to make sure that the public money is spent properly. And there's a review process where the contractors will look at it. The project manager hired by the teams has to review it. The county has to review it. And then finally it goes to the county clerk for a check to be cut. But the problem was that Hunt was so overwhelmed. Hunt Construction Group is a general contractor. They were so overwhelmed trying to get the thing opened on time that they were 4, 5, 6, 7 months behind on pay applications. For example, your company may have given them an invoice, and it wouldn't get to the teams for review until 4, 5, 6 months down the line.
Have the teams paid their share?
The teams, yeah, they say they have paid their share. But I'm told sources are telling me that, Hunt and a lot of the subs are taking losses on this, which is almost unavoidable because there's just so much pressure from the county and for everyone just to get the job done and do whatever it takes. And I'm told now that Hunt is just writing checks to get the thing done and move on.
All right. You mentioned in your story that at least 7 companies that are still owed millions of dollars. What are the reasons they've been given for why they haven't received their payments? And we're talking about people doing, electrical work or tile work or something like that.
Yeah, but that's those the big ticket items. There's an electrical company that says it's owed $7 million. There's a land clearing company that says it's owed $4 million. And a lot of that stuff is being disputed behind the scenes. The contractor wants to make sure that that there was such a rush to get it done that they barely, my sense at least, is that they barely had time to study a lot of these invoices as they came in because they wanted to get the work done and open the project. And they're scrutinizing everything now. And in just some emails and records that I've been reviewing for the last 2 weeks, there's indications that the contractor thinks that some of the overtime charges may have been inflated, sometimes two or three times as much as probably should have been charged. So they're just making sure that they're not getting taken advantage of too. But at the same time, a lot of the subs, they're pretty much aware that the general contractor is going to take a loss on this project, and they don't want to be squeezed as the contractor looks for ways to save money.
Again, I'm talking with Joe Capozzi of the Palm Beach Post. We're talking about the spring training facility in Palm Beach County that houses the Houston Astros and the Washington Nationals. There's a financial debacle here in that, one, as we just heard, the stadium isn't even done, and they played spring training last year, and they're going to be back in a couple of months. But also the fact that numerous companies that did work on this facility have yet to be paid. Who hasn't paid them and why? Joe, you said earlier that the teams really haven't been very public about their feelings on the stadium. But, I mean, has anybody complained about any shoddy work?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up because that's a big part of the problem, too, where the contractor and the teams, they don't want to pay for shoddy work, and that's what they're finding. And, in fact, we're going to have a story that will be out this Sunday that's going to detail a lot of the problems. And again, I told you up front that the players, for the most part, didn't complain. But for the whole spring training, there were showers in the clubhouses where, when you took the shower, you were sloshing around in ankle deep water because the floors weren't sloped correctly to go downward towards the drains. There were large empty buckets throughout the Astros clubhouse to catch leaks from faulty window installation and roof leaks. There was a brand new roof that was put on, but there was so much debris stored up there that some of the sharp objects penetrated, and there were a couple of heavy rainstorms, and the water just constantly dripped through.
How many lawsuits are there right now?
Well, there were about 10 that were filed, 5 were withdrawn, and there's about 5 more pending, including one where Hunt was the plaintiff against a Delray Beach glass company that they claimed just mishandled the entire project. Hunt had to hire a consultant to review the glass company's work. They found deficiencies. Hunt fired them, hired a brand new glass company, and that company is, as we speak, they're putting in the final window panes now. And they're hoping all of these issues are resolved by January, but still, that's a year behind the original target for getting the certificate of occupancy.
Some of these companies are too small to file any lawsuits. But you had pointed out one company had actually called the Houston Astros like right after they won the World Championship and said, "Hey, congrats, and where's our money?"
Yeah, you won the World Series and you won't pay your bills, which was kind of an unfair statement, but it just kind of illustrated the frustration that are being felt by the subs. There were letters going back and forth for several months trying to get their money, trying to get paid. And then I think we wrote something short on our website the day after the World Series where the Astros owner Jim Crane was kind of boasting about Palm Beach County deserves some of the praise. Their workers helped build the thing, and the fans supported us on the first road to the World Championship. And then when some of the subs read that, my phone's kind of lit up, and they're like, by the way, they haven't paid us. But again, as I tried to explain earlier, there's a long, complicated process where the Astros and the Nationals can't cut a check and hand it to the subcontractor. That check has to come from the general contractor, even though the money is coming from county coffers. So it's a very complicated process, and the Astros took exception to a lot of those comments that were made by the subs.
There we go. Sorry about that. A little technical.
Oh, that's okay.
You know what? just thinking real quickly, let's wrap up on this, is that spring training is just around the corner, as you mentioned, and well, you know what? That's going to be a weird moment, isn't it? You're going to have the championship team come to town, and fans are going to be happy about that. But, you know, county commissioners frustrated. You have these contractors, subcontractors frustrated. What do you expect if things aren't settled by March? What do you think is going to happen?
I think things will be settled. And again, a lot of these problems that we're talking about, if you pay for a ticket and you bring your kid to a ball game, you're going to have to really look hard to see deficiency. It's going to look like a nice new spring training facility. You're not going to see, you're not going to be inconvenienced by a lot of these problems with your experience of sitting at a ball game for 2 hours. I think that the county is really putting pressure behind the scenes on the teams to finish it. They're almost done with it, but the frustration is that here we are 12 months later and a lot of these smaller items are still lingering out there when they should have been taken care of a long time ago.
Well, you know what? Again, spring training is just around the corner. It's not like these players are playing the way they did in the movie Major League. They still have a lot of the amenities. And they won the World Series, for heaven's sakes. I guess it didn't matter.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Joe Capozzi of the Palm Beach Post. It's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, we'll have more on that story on our website coming up a little later on today on WLRN.org. All right, coming up next on Sundial. So what's it like when you're considered one of the 30 best in the country? For a restaurant owner. Right here in Miami, we're going to talk to one of them. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. So Forbes magazine recently released its 30 Under 30 list for food and drink for the upcoming year. This is a list of the 30 people who are breaking the mold, per se, and creating food and dining options that keep patrons coming back for more. Two of the people on that list are from Miami. One of them is Amanda Pizarro, co-founder of Wynwood Salty Donut. We'll talk to her next week. The other is David Fouquier, owner of Fouque's Restaurant in downtown Miami, and he joins me now in studio. Welcome. How are you doing?
Great, man. Thanks a lot for having me.
I appreciate you coming in. Explain this Forbes 30 Under 30 list. What is it, and what does it mean to you?
So it's essentially, I guess, something that Forbes has been doing for some time now. It's expanded to about, I think, 20 categories. It originally, food and beverage was one of the first ones that they did. It's essentially an award to recognize, you know, the 30 people under 30 years old who are making a difference that show a promising future in the business. And for Amanda and I, both being from Miami, under 30, I guess we fit the mold, and we both have two businesses that people really enjoy. And
Amanda is...
Amanda's the owner of the Salty Donut, who I've yet to meet, but I'm planning a dinner with her to do something
there
special.
There you go.
Do a little collaboration of sorts.
Well, I didn't want to get you both at the same time.
I want
to focus on each of you separately.
Absolutely.
Did they tell you why they chose you? Forbes.
To be honest with you, they tell you that there's a very rigorous selection process. I think they say that it's harder to get accepted than to get into Harvard. It's like a 3-4% acceptance rate of all the people that they vet out. So that was pretty cool, considering I was the black sheep in high school and there was no shot I was going to Harvard or anywhere for that matter.
There you go. Your restaurant, Fouque's, now in its third year, right?
It's about to be year three coming up in about a month and a half, 2 months.
This comes right out of your family heritage.
Pretty much, yeah. I was born and raised. I mean, we weren't in the restaurant business per se, but we were very... hospitable family, to say the least. Open door policy at all times. My house is kind of the gathering place for all and everybody, kind of no questions asked, whether we were, you know, 15 years old and acting like little idiots at the house, having big dinners, and either it would be, you know, cooking Persian feasts that my mom would have, or just ordering copious amounts of Chinese food.
No, because your mom
she's from Iran, yeah, originally. She left Iran a while back, and she moved to Switzerland and then over to the United States, where she ended up meeting my dad and creating the life for themselves.
And your dad is from?
My dad's French, from Paris originally. So I was pretty lucky. I had two cultures that were on both ends of the spectrum, hospitality in the more rigorous fine dining sense and one in the more open armed kind of just welcome to our home sense.
I just wonder what dinner was like.
It was interesting.
When you have these two different, cultural backgrounds, but give me an idea.
Oh man, my dad would sit there with his legs crossed, kind of like snarking at everybody, thinking he's better than the rest of the crew while we're just sitting here just trying to have a good time laughing. You know, the French are very serious by the books people, and they take their food very seriously. So my dad, you got to be at the table at 7 o'clock. You know, the wine's got to be open, ready to drink. The dessert and the cheese has to be on deck, ready to go the second he's done. And, you know, the Persian side of the family, you got 5 people showing up at 7, 5 people showing up at 7:45, then more people showing up at 8 and 9. And it was a big mess, but always a lot of fun growing up.
Was there a favorite dish that came from both sides of your family?
Yes, definitely. On my dad's side of the family, it was my grandma used to cook. Some of my first food memories, I think, are owed to my grandma on my French side. She's an amazing woman. She's 90 years old, I think, or 92 years old, and she still takes care of my grandpa every day, drives the car to the market every morning, picks out her produce, picks out her fish, goes to her fishmonger, goes to her meat guy, and cooks every single night. So growing up, I was we had these little soles, these like personal soles. The fish, it's a cold water fish, kind of like a flounder, that comes from the Mediterranean, and she would go pick them up. And the day that we would be there at her house and she'd get the soles was like the happiest day of all of our lives. We'd sit there, we'd fillet our own little fish, she'd saute it in butter and parsley, and it was just like a food memory that I remember me and all my cousins fighting over who would get the last little sole.
You've been back to, have you traveled to your parents' countries, home
to born? France several times. I spent a lot of time there growing up in the summers, but Iran, unfortunately, due to the political situation there, being Jewish, doesn't really bode too well over there, unfortunately. Although it's definitely a dream of mine to go back because I've embodied so much of like that part of my heritage, not only in my day-to-day life, but in what I do at the restaurant.
How much of the time that you spent in France helped shape, you know, your cooking style?
I think it was, first of all, I'm not a chef per se. I can cook. I can help in the kitchen if needed, but I'm really the creator more so than the chef. I think taking that term chef is disrespectful to the people out there who actually are.
All right, just to make sure. I think I just said your cooking style. I didn't say you were a chef.
No,
just to make sure, because I have had chefs in here. I know how defensive they get about that.
Yeah, I'm always I always like to remove myself from that because...
And yet, didn't you have, you had an apprenticeship,
yes,
right?
Yes, I definitely worked in kitchens, don't get me wrong. But my cooking style or my style of cuisine that I'm trying to represent right now is very much emblematic of the things that I grew up eating in New York with my Persian family. We had, you know, Persian stews and crispy rices and different soups and just colorful dishes and copious amounts of food. And that was kind of what I grew up eating. I'd have, you know, dinner and then leftovers for 3 days and then dinner and leftover for 3 days. So I guess I took a lot of these classic dishes that my mom and my grandma put on the table, and I introduced them to my team here at Fuchs Miami, and they kind of reinterpreted them using modern sophisticated ingredients and modern cooking techniques, and took some dishes that I grew up really being emblematic to my childhood and putting it on a really pretty plate for, you know, thousands of people to enjoy.
Take us back when you were ready to start your restaurant Fuchs again. Really that process in deciding, you know, not just the fact that you wanted to start a restaurant, but also it's the fact that, you know, you're trying to figure out the style. You have all of these different ideas, but really at the beginning there, what was the process for you? How did you come up with, you know, and it's changing, by the way, constantly changing.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, I was very fortunate at the time to find a chef who believed in me. I was 24 years old when I approached her. And although it was definitely, you know...
This is your first chef?
My first chef, yeah. Her name was Nicole Vitano. She was working for Michelle Bernstein at the time, and I think she was kind of trying to take the next step in her career, and she saw an opportunity with a young guy who really wanted to make something happen, do something different, and make moves, and she believed in me. So we had the idea originally to create, you know, something that was honest and true and really what we called feel-good food, put food out there that came from the local farmers, that was farmed responsibly, sourced responsibly. And we were really one of the first people, you know. I mean, I'm not going to say the first, because there's obviously people before me, but we were one of the first people to really embody that movement of farm to table, quote-unquote. I hate using that word because it's gotten recycled way too much. But we started with that idea, and she had a couple of her signature dishes. She was Italian-American at the time. And I knew that I wanted to do, you know, something along the lines of my Mediterranean, Middle Eastern roots.
And that's interesting. How do you then decide what the menu is going
to
be?
So we kind of like made a hosh-posh of all the things that we loved to begin with. And it was a hit right off the bat. You know, she had a signature dish called the Bucatini Amatriciana, which is still on the menu today.
And what is it?
It's a spicy bacon, tomato, and olive, an onion sauce pasta with a thick, basically a tubular spaghetti that is hollowed out in the middle. And it has this like rich creaminess due to the cheese and the butter that it's just hot, sweet, savory, everything all in a bowl of pasta, everything that you want in a bowl of pasta. And it's been like a cult dish, let's call it. You know, people stop me everywhere. Hey, you're Bucatini. Hey, you're Bucatini. So, you know, for that, I'm forever grateful. Unfortunately, she left after about a year, and I had to kind of find the restaurant's identity a little bit, and that forced me to like look within a little bit as well and find, you know, what it is that I felt best represented Fuchs, which is essentially, you know, my heritage, my upbringing, and the things that I enjoy serving and enjoy eating. So,
and who was that second chef?
The second chef was a gentleman named Brian Rojas, who was very, very talented, dear friend of mine. Ended up having a baby and couldn't keep up the rigorous hours of working 80 hours a week. So we had to move on from him after about a year and a half. But he really started taking on my Persian and kind of Middle Eastern vibes. I brought him to New York. He tried my family's food. I bought him a bunch of cookbooks. He got really into it. And next thing you know, he was telling me, David, I want to cook Persian food. So it was music to my ears.
How did the menu change? Every time you bring in a new chef too, especially.
Yeah, it was like a pretty natural evolution. You know, you never want to like take something and flip it upside down right away. You know, you got to ease into it. You got to ease into people's palates, and you got to find out what is working well, what's not working well, what are people ready for, what are they not ready for. And I think that like slowly but surely we were able to gear more away from what Nicole was doing into what Brian and I wanted to do. And then now my third chef, Saul Ramos, who's awesome, this kid's an absolute legend, has come in and really, really just took everything that Brian laid down and just ran with it and is embodying everything that he embodied, plus, you know, giving it his own twist and his own sort of, you know, flavor style, so to speak. And he's been a blessing to have.
Again, I'm talking with David Fouquier. He's the owner of Fuchs Restaurant in downtown Miami, and he was just listed, his place was just listed, on Forbes magazine's list of 30 under 30 for food and drink in the upcoming year. Again, the 30 people that you need to keep an eye on, and there were two from Miami. So that is quite amazing when you look at the list. I mean, a lot of New York, a lot of San Francisco, places like that. I wonder, going back to this idea, when you lose a chef, I mean, at that moment, what's that process like? You know, can you just go pluck some chef from somewhere else, or, you know?
Oof, this is an interesting question. To be honest with you, the first time I lost my chef, it was like my heart fell out from underneath me. You know, it was like a feeling where, like, it felt like everything was ending, you know? You just don't really know what to do. It's as your chef, it's the person who's running the restaurant. And I had a bit of a breakdown. But it took me a couple of days. I snapped out of it. I got really lucky. You know, I've stayed very involved in the community here, and I've always been, you know, active, talking to chefs, talking to managers, talking to owners, and being just present. And I think that really helped me in being able to get on my feet and find the right person. And I got really lucky the first time around. I did tastings for 3-4 chefs that are all pretty successful chefs now. And I ended up finding Brian, and I selected him based on what I thought were skills that I was looking for. And that was a little bit harder because my chef had given me like barely a 2 weeks notice at the time. So, you know, with 2 weeks, it's a little bit tough going into the end of your first year. But it ended up working out for the best. There was definitely like a bit of a lull you know, it takes time. You can't just jump right back on the horse. You got to get on the four-wheelers first. And that's what happened. And then the second time around, I had developed such a great relationship with the chef that he had let me know 2 months ahead of time that, you know, I want to be here. I want to be with you, but I got to be there for my family. And one of the things that people know about me is, if you know me, is that I'm a very family-oriented person. You know, my fiance, my mother, my father, my brother, they're pretty much like what keep me going on a day-to-day. And now my family at the restaurant, which is really like the family that I'm the most proud that I created.
So part of, obviously part of success in a restaurant's got to be the menu, but the other part I'd imagine has to be the atmosphere.
Yeah.
What's unique about Fuchs?
100%. You know, like I could say to you, part of the reason why we've been able to sustain three chefs now is because we're not a chef-centric restaurant. We're, you know, and I try to make it as much of a team effort as possible. You know, I think the chef is only as good as his cooks. The servers are only as good as their manager, and you know, the whole team is only as good as its weakest link. So I've been able to create an environment within the staff where people feel really comfortable coming to work and feel like it's a safe place where they could come and express themselves and be the person that they want to be and feel like there's really full support. And that's kind of the mission statement at Fuchs. And I think that that's what makes Fuchs special. Like, you come to the restaurant, yeah, like I discussed, we have the Bucatini Matriciana. Yes, we have, you know, signature Persian dishes that get people coming back for more. But it's really this, like, esoteric feeling when you walk in the door where you just feel really, like, welcome and at ease. And that's kind of the way that I try and lead my life.
What's up next for you?
So I'm going back home to New York to open my second restaurant. I'm staying locally in Miami. I'm very lucky. I have my brother Josh and my partner Naz that are going to be heading the restaurant. But we're opening a little sushi restaurant.
Didn't you do some
sushi? Yeah, I spent
sushi?
Some time in Japan after college learning how to make sushi. And I got hooked. I got the sushi bug. And I was put in touch with this phenomenal chef who was... too good of an opportunity to pass on, and we've been working on this for almost 3 years, so it's a long time, much longer than Fuchs was in the making, but it's also a bit of a different scale. We're opening in New York's Upper East Side, so it's a lot of pressure. New York City, you know, it's a big animal, millions and millions of people, millions of eyes watching, and you know, that's really the biggest stage. So for me, it's exciting to go home. You know, 5 blocks from where I grew up, 5 blocks from where I went to high school. We're creating a very traditional Tokyo-style sushi experience, a restaurant that's going to be built by some of the top carpenters in Japan, piece by piece, and shipped back over here in shipping containers, reassembled. It's been an insane opportunity and an insane ride. My brother is, hats off to him, because he's just 24 years old and he's just killing it.
What are you doing for Thanksgiving?
You know, this is a sad question. This is my first...
working, right?
Yeah, this is my first Thanksgiving without my family, to be honest. My brother and my mom are going to be in New York. My dad's traveling, and I'm kind of left alone. So I'm going to have a dinner at the restaurant tonight with my staff, whoever is able to come and join. And then I had my chef order me a personal turkey that I'll end up cooking probably for me and my roommate, Lewis. And yeah, that's it, unfortunately, this year for Thanksgiving. It's a tough one. So
your roommate
sensitive
Lewis.
Question.
Your roommate Lewis. Maybe it's me, right?
Hey, there you go. You come join us.
Anything for a free meal. David Fouquier, again, owner of Fuchs Restaurant. It just made Forbes magazine's 30 under 30 list. David, thank you so much. And
thanks,
congratulations,
Lewis.
By
appreciate
the way.
Appreciate it, man. Look forward. I hope to have you guys all at the restaurant. By the way, we're located at 1035 North Miami Avenue, right down the block from WLRN.
You know, I was going to have that on the website, too. So, David, thanks so much, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
All right, coming up next on Sundial, we're going to be talking about the local music scene. And don't forget that even though it's Black Friday coming up, it's also Small Business Saturday, too. We'll talk about that all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, so how would you describe Miami's music scene? You know, for years, Miami, of course, was synonymous with Gloria Estefan or John Secada. Go back further, you got Two Live Crew. Even further, Casey and the Sunshine Band. And then, of course, there's Pitbull and DJ Khaled. But There's more to the music scene than that. And one of the places you go if you want to find out about the underground scene, Sweat Records, founded by Lauren Reskin in 2005. Her shop has become a central place for music lovers in Miami to find a vast collection of music from South Florida, as well as watch performances live. And she joins us now live in studio. You go by Lolo. So yes. I'm going to call you Lolo.
Thank you.
Hey,
great
welcome.
To be here.
Thank you so much for being here. All right. So you know what? I was thinking about the music scene. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about, we always hear it like certain cities have that history, right? So, I mean, Motown, Detroit, Seattle, the grunge scene, and you can, you know, name different cities and their scene. But does Miami have a scene?
Well, we do, and we have history. I mean, in the 60s, we were, you know, Overtown area was the Harlem of the South, and there was a ton of amazing venues and musical performances and record labels, Deep City, Glades, things like that, that happened around then. And a lot of the members of that scene are still active. There was just a book fair panel on South Florida soul. So it's amazing that we do have that history so close to us. And then, yes, of course, the Miami bass and everything before that. And that has evolved, plus everything else you mentioned, and mixed up with all the influx and outflux of people that come through South Florida, into a really incredible, diverse scene that has everything. And all you need to do is look for it, and you will find everything from the Gong Orchestra concert that I attended last night to, you know, Spam All-Stars doing their thing any night of the week and all kinds of weird stuff. So it's a great time to be into music in South Florida.
You started Sweat Records in 2005. Mm-hmm. Vinyl was not the thing back then. Growing now. But I mean, when you started, was it mostly vinyl? What were you selling?
We were about half and half with CDs and vinyl when we first opened. CDs peaked in 99 and sort of went down from there. And vinyl has been on the double digit up and up since 2005 or six.
That is such a strange thing to say.
Yeah.
Now, granted, I mean, I go places now and I see a lot of vinyl. And look, I mean, look, I'm a Gen Xer. So I remember my turntable, which I sadly don't have right now. And I will get one by promise. But I had my records. I had my 45s. That was my favorite thing. And now all of a sudden it's in a world of digital. We're back to vinyl?
Absolutely back to vinyl. There's a return to sound quality. People are into things sounding good again. People are spending money on headphones and sound systems and turntables. And, you know, to me, one of the best things about it is, you know, everything is so digital, and the people that grew up just a generation below us have maybe never had a physical format music collection. And what better way to kind of rebel or, you know, dive into the counterculture than by buying a giant analog piece of vinyl. And we love that we're able to provide that service. Every time a teenager comes into the store and walks out with a great record, you know, our hearts swell and we know we're doing the job we're supposed to be doing.
I'll tell you what, no, this is a fun segment for me because it does help allow me to reminisce a little bit. And it is weird that I'll go through my collection of music and it's on my iPad or computer. And my favorite thing ever growing up, it wasn't mine, it was my grandparents. They had a fake fireplace that was a turntable.
Wow.
No, this was the coolest thing. It was a fake fireplace. You open the lid, and it was two turntables, and then the two sides were the pockets for all the vinyl.
Wow, quite a console.
I had to say that because I miss it. When you started this way, you were 21.
Yes, somewhere around there.
In 2005, why did you want to go into this business? You were already a DJ, but you loved music.
Yeah, and I'd worked at the Virgin Megastore that was down south in Sunset Place. And I knew that Miami, though a very spread out town, did have a great population of music lovers from all over. And I really just wanted Miami as my hometown to have an indie record store that was the classic kind of store, but for Miami's tastes. And people down here have great taste in music. People love all kinds of different genres. And we wanted Sweat Records to be the kind of place that local people considered their friendly local record store. So we have so many regular customers. We do tons of special orders for people. We have a lot of niche things and hard to find records that, you know, you can't walk in anywhere else and find. So we're really happy to have, you know, such a selection and such a great customer base that really appreciates it.
What, in 2005, and because I wasn't here, but what did they have? What kind? I mean, you were at the big mega stores, you said Virgin, but I mean, what did Miami have for a local store?
Sort of by the time I'd graduated high school, a lot of the smaller ones had closed, but we had, you know, Y&T is still down there on Bird Road. Evan runs that. It's more of used kind of stuff. Virgin was starting to pick up on vinyl again, but I just knew that, you know, there were a lot of things wrong in the big corporate model that kind of didn't make it as friendly to local entities as it could have been. So, you know, for instance, if you're a local group and you were trying to get your CD on the shelves at Virgin, it was kind of a cumbersome process and usually it didn't really happen. It was pretty hard for bands to do that. Whereas with Sweat, if somebody makes something with nice packaging, and please let it be vinyl, we're thrilled to sell it in the store. And one of the greatest things that's happened to the music scene in the last 6 months is we got a vinyl plant again, which Sun Press Vinyl, making records down here for the first time in, I think, 10 years.
I wanted to ask you about that because that was one of the things, is that making vinyl, you know, I mean, when vinyl disappeared way back, I guess, in the 80s, started to disappear, I should say. So the places you can go to make vinyl were disappearing as well. So it, I mean, so now there's a little bit more opportunity for this.
So much more. And I mean, for the local scene to have a plant so close is incredible because you save on shipping costs and you get to be a little more involved in the process. It's not as much of a kind of scary, you know, blind process as, you know, sending it away to some plant somewhere else. But the plants are growing like crazy. They just had the first ever vinyl manufacturers conference up in Detroit last weekend, making vinyl. And, you know, it's amazing that they've got that going on in 2017, and these people are dedicated, and it's really wonderful to watch, and so many labels are just going above and beyond, putting out incredible packaging.
What do you hear from, you know, the smaller groups and performers? You know, do they prefer to make vinyl or press it somewhere else, you know, create their audio somewhere else?
Well, the people that we've spoken to that have pressed locally have all had great experiences, and we are starting to see more local vinyl releases, period, which is great. You know, we can't wait to see our whole local section explode with a variety of new releases by local artists. So the more of that that happens, the better. And, you know, the way the plants work, they walk you through the process and make sure you know you need to get your music separately mastered for vinyl. You know, it is more of an art form than just kind of sending some digital files and having a CD plant chunk them out. But
okay, what is the coolest looking vinyl album that you've seen?
I mean, well, the coolest one ever is probably the Robert Rauschenberg Talking Heads packaging that he did back in the 80s that, you know, comes in a translucent plastic clamshell with different layers of screen printed plastic.
They always got very creative with those.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. But these days, I mean, the band Run the Jewels put out an album with a lot of cat samples. And so they came out with a furry album cover to go with that. There's a lot of cool lenticular covers, everything from NWA to, I don't even know. There's, you know, one of the great things about the revival right now is people are just totally going all out with packaging and bonus things. And the other great part about it is you almost every time you get the digital files with it. So it's sort of a win-win because you get a big, pretty record and then you get files to have for your devices.
I'm talking with Lola Reskin. She is the founder and owner of Sweat Records. And, you know, we're talking about the music scene here in South Florida, but we're also going to be talking about Small Business Saturday because that is coming up this weekend. After the holiday, it's time to start shopping for Christmas. You know what I wondered, too, is when did you start? Because it's what's unique about your place is not just that you're going to find this really expansive collection, especially, as you said, some hard-to-find stuff, is that you have performances. You also sell coffee, too, as well. So that's a plus.
Yes.
But when did you start doing the performances?
Pretty much as soon as we opened, we had a backyard space in our first location, and immediately people started approaching us to play. And I had been a concert promoter, event promoter, DJ, et cetera, and loved doing things like that. And people were coming to us with great ideas, and so we just started having them on a regular basis. And then when Hurricane Wilma forced us to move about not even 8 months later, when we set up our new space, we knew we wanted to have a stage and host in-store events. And lately, we've been throwing a lot of vinyl release parties, which is our favorite thing. And, you know, we're the vinyl store. We love celebrating when people, you know, embrace the format that we're embracing. So I grew up down here. I was very frustrated growing up as far as my options of what I could do as a music lover. And so when we had, you know, from the beginning, basically all ages events were very important to us. And almost every event we have in the store is all ages are welcome. And we encourage people to bring their kids, their nephews, their nieces, their cousins, anyone who they think would benefit from the experience of seeing some cool local live music, getting inspired by people getting up on stage and performing, and inspired by, you know, just flipping through the racks and seeing the true variety of what's out there. Because you can click around in Spotify or iTunes, and that's great for discovery. But real life discovery is also really, really fun.
Now, because you mentioned Hurricane Wilma, so that was just barely after you started.
Yeah.
And it damaged your store.
Completely, yeah. It was very shocking, to say the least, but it was one of the most significantly damaged buildings in the whole county. And so we had no choice but to move, and thankfully we were able to move into a small space behind Churchill's Pub. And then within a year, we moved into our current space, which is up front on 2nd Avenue next door to Churchill's. And it's a good synergy as they're a music venue. We're a music store, so it's a nice block.
When you do the performances, by the way, are you really just focused on local bands, local groups?
We do get national, international acts through. It just sort of depends on what we think will work in the store. But we had Nightmares on Wax from London play in the store. We've had Bonnie Prince Billy, who's a huge national artist, play. For the most part, we do a lot of local stuff, and we're happy to do that, especially when bands are really making the effort and putting out physical format materials.
I mean, because again, this we go back to your promoting days. I mean, is it really about helping that the local artists, get their footing or build themselves up?
Yeah, definitely. Our artist development is very important down here, and we see a lot of bands working really hard and a lot of bands thinking they're working really hard and wondering why things aren't handed to them. But, if a band is coming to us and they have, plans and releases and merchandise, all those things make it way more likely for us to want to book them. We also do monthly or semi-monthly music movie screenings of cool music documentaries. We usually do those with O Cinema and Wynwood. We love partnering with other organizations. And our favorite series that's all ages as well is called Classic Album Sundays. And that's a hi-fi listening party we do once a month. And we have a partner in Deja Vu Audio South, which is an incredible audiophile boutique in Wynwood. And they bring in a ridiculous sound system. And people sit and listen to two entire albums on vinyl, listening as people together in a room. And it is really magical.
All right. So we'll talk about the local music scene. So tell me at least a couple of groups or performers here locally we don't know about we should be paying attention to.
Sure. Well, one of our favorites is Richie Hell, and he's actually going to be playing at the store on Small Business Saturday. And he's from Argentina, moved here a couple years ago, and he does a really cool sort of Thievery Corporation-esque world party music. And we love him. He's got an amazing 12-inch record out that was pressed at Sun Press and some other cool merch. And we're excited to have him be playing that night. And along with him is a newer band called Donzi, which is sort of a New York post-punk flavor of group, and they're local people we've known for a while, and we got to see them live and we love them and brought them in. So I know they're working on vinyl and we're showcasing them both Saturday night for free.
When a performer comes up to you, because they know at this point that hey, if you're going to do anything, you got to go through Sweat Records. You have to. But I mean, is there a process? I don't know if you have a long list of people coming at you, but is there a process to say, this is what we want to highlight?
Well, we pretty much want to help anyone that's working hard on their own music. So we will, on consignment, sell any local record. If you get to the next level, we'll buy them outright. But, if you want to bring us a couple copies of a record you made, we're happy to sell them. We'll put on the shelves. We'll put up your poster. We have free channels online that bands can add their shows to our calendar page that gets tons of hits. So, we try to have resources for the bands available. And, if bands are willing to work hard down here, as I heard Spam All Stars in the theme song here, they've put their dues in, and it's no wonder that they're so popular because these are some of the most hardworking guys in Miami.
All right. So obviously Thanksgiving is coming up, and after that is Black Friday. Thank goodness I work because I avoid that day at all costs.
Yeah.
One thing that, not a lot of people talk about as much, but we know about is Small Business Saturday.
Yes.
That's an important thing for you.
Yeah. Well, one of the cool things about the day before is they actually do Record Store Day, Black Friday now. And Record Store Day is the big day in April where all these exclusive releases come out. You have to be an independent store to order them. You're not going to find that stuff in Target. And people line up around the block to be able to get their hands on these limited pieces. And so Record Store Day, Black Friday is sort of a smaller extrapolation of that. And there's a bunch of cool stuff coming out Friday morning, and we'll also have people lining up. So we're excited for that. It's a more low-key Black Friday option. No one's going to get trampled. And we're all just going to be celebrating music and drinking some cider. And then, Small Business Saturday is really important. I really believe that small businesses are the soul of their communities. Nobody feels like a community has soul because of a new corporate restaurant or a public storage unit. So, there's so many incredible entities in Miami, Books and Books, that are inspirational to us. And, it's important for people to be able to go into a store and have a local experience. And we do actually get a ton of tourists, and all of them are looking for Miami flavor.
I wondered real quickly in this world today with, these large conglomerates and corporations that, how small businesses are doing. And I know it depends on the industry, but, and I'm wondering, like with the music business, how much it's changed. But I mean, you're the testament that it still works. It's still around. But I also remember too, is that growing up as a kid, there were so many music stores. I don't see it as much.
Yeah. It's interesting. In regards to record stores, one of my favorite Record Store Day quotes is about how small stores are all we had in the beginning and they're all we have left. And I kind of enjoy that because music's very personal. And, you know, even though there are fewer stores in total, the ones that are still around are all seem to be doing very well. We have new stores opening in Miami. Lucky Records is new in Wynwood. And Brooklyn Vintage Vinyl opened in Alapata last year. So, you know, we definitely have more options down here, which is great. And across the country, the strength of things like Record Store Day and the whole resurgence of vinyl has really strengthened a lot of stores. So I wouldn't get too despondent about it, but,
I'm not despondent, but, you know.
Yeah.
All right. Again, Lola Reskin, owner of Sweat Records. Small Business Saturday is coming up. But you know what? Lolo, it's great to finally have you in here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Lewis.
All right. And that is the end of the program. I thank you so much for listening. I'm Lewis Hernandez. By the way, just to mention, the group we're listening to is Palo.
Oh, Palo. My bad. My bad, right. Buddies. Love them too.
Thanks so much. And have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.